Next keynote speaker, Dr. Andreas Weigel.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning. I'm going to talk about the unrealized power of data. And I want to start asking you, where do you think the bottlenecks are for you in your daily work? Is it that computer power is missing, storage missing, bandwidth missing, maybe data collection devices are missing? Is it the software implementations are not good enough? That the algorithms themselves need to be developed further? That there might be not enough data? Let me hear a little bit from you. Where do you think your daily bottlenecks are? What would be your wish list if you could have something changed by me in the next 50 minutes?
Data integration and the mentality of a lot of people.
Data integration and the mentality of a lot of people. Okay? Absolutely. I am going to talk about mind shifts. That's a good one. Say again?
Data quality.
Okay. So that's a question about who fixes the data. And there we'll hear something about as well. Yes?
IT and their slow update cycle.
Okay. Anything else?
Communication breakdown among the departments.
Communication between the silos, from silos to synergies. Okay.
Documentation,
you said? Okay, good. So what we see here is that people are not complaining about not having good enough algorithms. The 90s were characterized by the question, given a set of data, what insights can we get? Whereas this decade is much more characterized by the question, given a certain problem, what data can we get? So what I'll do in the next 45 minutes is I'll walk you through a historical perspective about business, data, and communication. I then show you a few of the current trends as I see them that primarily come from the fact that communication has become so cheap. I'm going to talk about how we move or can move from transaction economics via interactions to relationship economics and what the implications are for this, for the consumer data revolution. This mind shift of people to share data if and only if they get something out of it. Then I like to have the term that we move from CRM to CMR, from customer relationship management to customer managed relationships. And I'll show you a few cases where the arrow, if you will, has been reversed. Sometimes I call it that move from e-business, where the firm is in the center, to me-business, where the individual is in the center. Applications to business is what I call marketing 2.0, which is precisely not the siloed people coming up with a message like an aria, which is composed and then performed, but which is much more of an interaction. That's one of the challenges many of you face in organizations. Why do we talk here about predictive analytics? Because of relevance. For me, the entire framework for this is a relevance framework. And we'll see that relevance actually comes up with respect. If a company gives relevant message to you, respect them. And if they respect you, they don't spam you with random stuff. And then I spend the last few minutes with a very pragmatic framework, with 5 steps you need to do in order to get there. And since we all want to be famous, I call it the FAME framework: problem, hypothesis, action, metrics, and last but not least, experiments. All right. So if we go back to the 70s. In the 70s, there were maybe 10 million people using computers. And what that meant was basically that the back office was digitized. Not much predictive analytics there, but a lot of reporting and clearly a cost center. Then the 80s, the back office got connected with the front office. For instance, in the airline, they still use the same key sequence of strokes here. In the airline, they put something in there, and then they learn that there's a seat on a certain plane 300 days in the future. And maybe it's about, I would think, 100 million people who would be in that area who now use computers, data, and communication. In the 90s, you all know, the web came along. So now we had about 1 billion people involved, but most of them just poking at stuff. And what happened this decade is that we moved from the pure poking at stuff to actually contributing. So maybe 100 million, maybe more than that, of people actually are peer producing. So that is my view of how the data in business has changed over the last few years. For the modeling, when I prepared for this talk, I saw an old poster here, which I did in 1991 of the Santa Fe prediction competition, where we picked six sets, Neil Gershenfeld and myself, and the continuation was safely in my drawer at Xerox PARC. And we asked the world, pre-web, via FTP, to actually tell us what they think the continuations on a set of different metrics would be. So I'm very much at heart a person who believes that the only thing I really trust is out-of-sample predictions. Underlying this shift in the last 20, 30 years is the fact that communication cost has basically dropped to zero. That means that the one-way communication of, you know, 1 million people poking at stuff now has become two-way communication. That means that people are able to contribute data and also to fix data. Whereas before they were only to look at stuff, they might have seen that it was wrong, but they couldn't do anything about it. From an economics perspective, if the cost of you, several people from Capital One, sending out stuff has, if it's in the physical world, basically become zero, then the dominant cost is the cost of the receiver. Now, the receiver doesn't have a group of 50 statisticians who can help him find relevant stuff. So the problem has become that because the cost of sending has dropped, the shift burden has now landed on the shoulders of the receiver. And what does that mean? What costs are there? Not just my cost of storage or my laptop, but it's the cost of giving attention, the cost of interrupts. So, by the way, the attention game is not really about giving attention, but it's about getting attention. If you think about this bi-directional communication, for instance, on Facebook, the attention game means that, hey, people want to be poked, people want to be stroked, and whatever else people do on Facebook. By the way, how many of you are on Facebook? Okay, almost three-quarters. Good. One of the consequences of the communication costs bidirectionally having dropped to zero is that the natural time scale, which used to be that Capital One sends out a letter, it takes a few days, and then maybe I'll fill it out and send it back, it takes another few days, that net natural time scale has basically reduced to zero. So the protection we had about having natural time scales, having natural costs have disappeared. And to make it even worse, the consumer is essentially always on. So whether you look at this as worse or better is up to you. But the point is, we really live in a very different regime as far as creation of data is concerned. Creation of data. Here, about there are 100 gigabytes stored for all of us on this planet. Per person. And the doubling scale is between 1 and 2 years. For instance, YouTube, every minute, 15 hours of user-generated content gets uploaded. Or let's take something even more common, namely Flash. As I was preparing this talk, I got the following screen. Adobe Flash Player settings, privacy. Allow S3, Amazon, AWS.com to access your camera and microphone. Of course, yay. I mean, you know, that way they know what situation I'm in and they can show me even better ads. Turn on the camera, turn on the microphone. That about data generation in a bidirectional way. Or this one. Who of you might know IMMI, Integrated Media Measurement Incorporated? Just down in the peninsula. Okay, a couple of people. So here's how it works. You get a mobile phone for free. And every 10 seconds, the phone integrates, trying to figure out what it hears, and then every half minute sends it up to headquarters. So for instance, in my case this morning, 9:17, Alarm rings. 9:18, Andreas in the shower. 9:19, Andreas out of the shower. Clearly a person for, you know, integrated shampoo, body lotion, and everything in one shot. So they know a lot about me. That's data which we had never thought about before. So the trends which come out of this is that market research now has the power of combining implicit data, like IMMI's data, or like my clicks, with good old explicit data. And we shouldn't throw the kid out with the bathwater. I actually was the first one who ran surveys at Amazon.com when I was chief scientist there, because John Doerr, one of the VCs Amazon has, asked me, why do people come to Amazon.com expecting I would do some complicated analysis? But I mean, hey, simple question of simple answers. So you just go and ask the people. And the interesting thing was not to know why people come, but to understand the discrepancies between what they said they wanted to do and what they actually did. For instance, half of the people who buy something at Amazon.com did not come with an explicit intent to buy. They said, hey, I just want to see what's new out there, want to check my status of the order, and so on and so forth. But half of the sales, an amazing percentage, 50%, is made by people who just come for other reasons. Recommendations, by the way, depending on the category, have roughly a 10, 15, 20, 25% uplift. So recommendations are an important element. Beautiful example of predictive modeling. On the other hand, not all is perfect. It turns out that from those people who come with explicit intent to buy, only 1/3 buy within 24 hours, within a day. So that actually then leads us to, of course, understand, well, what happened in those sessions? And by combining explicit data with implicit data, we can then actually figure out that, for instance, 5-6 years ago, search was not doing well. And that led to the generation of A9, for instance. When I think about the current trend, with the plethora of data which has been collected, we have moved from what I call strong models, where there are strong assumptions, to weak models, where we can relax those strong assumptions. So economists, for instance, who get quarterly data points, they have a very intimate relationship with each of these data points. And in order to make any predictions, they need to make strong assumptions about heteroscedasticity and normality of whatever they have. At a company like Amazon, where there are millions of visitors every day, you don't have to worry about statistical significance. You have to worry about relevance. You don't have to worry about distributions because you just measure the stuff. So that's what I say, we move from an assumption-rich or assumption-heavy model to a data-rich model. Very different skill sets needed for that. And finally, we move from transactions where we only know, think, market basket analysis, what people buy at the end, upstream into the decision process. So we move from just knowing the transactions, which is enough for making recommendations of people bought X, also bought Y, to knowing the interactions that led to those transactions. An example of exploiting those data is people looked at X, eventually bought Y. Think about this subtle shift, how one thing is not particularly predictive, whereas the other thing is much more predictive because there's upstream interaction, which downstream leads to the purchase. Now, we then can move, if we have persistent idea of the person, from transactions to actual relationships. And if you think about relationship economics, the long-term economics in relationships, you do very different things from short-term transaction economics. You come from a variety of different backgrounds. If you think about, most of you came here by plane, if you think about it, the airline which you came in probably has some loyalty program and probably prides themselves that, you know, they have a relationship with you. But if you think about it, it really is a transaction business. Hey, you buy your ticket and good luck, young man. If the plane is late and you miss your connection, you know, you take over yourself. So it is not that the user is in center, but it's still transaction-based. So when we are talking here about what can be changing, I invite you to think about how can we move from a short-term transaction business to a long-term relationship business. This is the implication from the company's perspective. It is driven by a change in the customer's mind, and that I call the customer data revolution. Most companies that ask me to help them with a problem come with a mindset of, can you help us sniff the digital exhaust? And that, ladies and gentlemen, can be bad for your health. Facebook last week being another example of people not being happy with the privacy policy. Now, what's new even in the digital exhaust is that we have many more data sources, especially location data, which we did not have access to before. So you all bring your mobiles. Some of you have GPS on them. Last year, Nokia alone sold 100 million mobile phones with GPS. But even triangulation by base station is not bad at all. We know who moves together. We know even if you compare it to your calendar that you might be running a little bit late because you want to be there already, but your mobile says you're not there yet, etc. Amazing capabilities from these implicit data to build products for people by making predictions of the situation they are in. The second step here is not the implicitly clandestine and connected data, but the explicitly shared data by the users. It's amazing how many people share all kinds of stuff about themselves on Facebook. What can we do and what should we do with those data? An example from health insurance at the East Coast. I read about an economist. I have no relationship with the company or the people there. The economist said that there's a young girl who was anorexic, eating disorder. And she had to go to hospital. And it was about $1,000 a day, what she needed for a month, per day. And her mom, it was a poor family, handed the bill in to the health insurance. And apparently there are two kinds of anorexia. And one of them, the health insurance needs to pay. The other one, they find some way of not paying. So what did the health insurance do first thing? They looked at all the records that girl had created, MySpace, on Facebook, etc., just in order to make the case that they don't have to pay. One of the data I have not put up online, although as you know, some people call me a digital exhibitionist who even puts up his schedule on whatever I do, is my DNA. I did do 23andMe, which is having your DNA partially sequenced to understand, you know, what the future might bring for you. But I worry that despite all the laws in whatever 40 years from now, somebody will say, you know, you had this up there and we don't cover that case. So in this consumer data revolution here, individuals talk about themselves, reveal so much, and it really is very important for companies to have a very solid consumer-centric stance here. Otherwise, people will not share with you. The third element here is that people don't only reveal stuff about themselves, but they all reveal stuff about their relationship to others. If you think about identity, my passport, I have a house in China, has a good visa for China. If half of you grab my passport, you can probably get into China with that passport because, you know, for Chinese people, we look all alike. But if any of you grabs my Facebook password, I think within a couple of minutes, somebody will say, hey, Andreas, are you all right? Because the interactions are so much more stable, the style of speaking we have, our relations with people, than, if you think about it, the biometrics of a picture, you know, on a piece of paper. So there are big implications here, what it really means. But at the heart, what I want to make out for this point here about the new data sources is that the consumer data revolution is about shifting expectations. That people want to get back something in return of what they're given in terms of data. Now, Amazon is a very good company and had many ideas. And I just want to give you one example here, which is Amazon Wishlist. Here in front of mine in Los Angeles, I was just absolutely amazed what books he had on his wish list that I knew about half of the authors on his book list from my monitor engagements personally. So you do something for yourself. He does it for himself, he wants to remember what he has, and maybe every now and then somebody buys a book for him. So that is an example here of customers happily sharing with the world because they get something back. Again, downside of this was about 8 years ago, and I was told this by the roommate of the person in the consideration here, was a journalist in Berlin. I was told was turned back by the United States in JFK immigration officer because the immigration officer was very smart after 9/11 and looked at the wish list and decided subjects with such tastes are not desirable as journalists in the United States. So it's again, I don't want to just create a negative picture or positive picture, but those data can be used in many ways. Of course, for Amazon, this is a rich data source where people manually group stuff together. It is, just to repeat the phrase from before, going upstream in the decision process. That people, as they have a consideration set of books they might be interested in, make that consideration set available to others and allow others to discover things based on their having done hard work in order to add stuff together. Okay. That was what I wanted to say about the historical perspective, some of the trends, and now I'm coming to the heart, which is what are the implications here for business? There I want to talk about how we move from CRM, which are systems most of you run, to CMR. So true customer centricity, which I do believe ultimately is the goal, true customer centricity empowers the customer to make better decisions. So Amazon's view is not that Amazon wants to sell as many books as it can. That would be a short-term transactional goal. But Amazon's view is that it wants to, in the long term, have a relationship with the customers, and it wants to support its customers in the decision-making process. So often we talk about customer value. Come with me here. When you say customer value, you mean, most of you, the value the customer has for the company. But there's also the value the company has for the customer. So that shift, or that reversing the arrow, if you will, is an exercise which often I think what would Amazon do is something which I try to do with clients. What if we reverse the arrow? And it's not always in one direction. For instance, I gave a talk last week in Amsterdam where we had basically all the major carriers there. And the question there was not, what can the carrier do for the customer? It would be great, for instance, to have a mobile signal which doesn't get dropped as I drive to Stanford, but that's a different story. But the question should be, what can the customer do for the carrier? For instance, the carrier could allow us on a map, on a simple Google map, an hour's worth of time, of developer time, to just put little pins on that map and allow us to communicate in a bidirectional way with the carrier where the problems are. Sure, you can get it through data analysis by knowing that, funny, many people seem to be stopping their calls right as they turn into 280. Or you can just allow people to contribute data. That's sort of this bidirectional relationship I'm talking about. I did some work with Best Buy, and it is interesting how Best Buy, 130,000 employees, is realizing that one, by tapping into the intelligence of their employees and allowing them to annotate stuff, to make little stores, and two, by tapping into the attention of all of their customers, can have a significantly better service and product than if they pay some people somewhere in the world to come up with product descriptions. So historically, 10 years ago, and there's some good papers about this, people used to shop at the first place they went to online. And there was this notion of customer relationship management, as I mentioned before, which is like flypaper. Customer comes, puts his little leg there, and customer stays. Customer retention. Now that has gone. The next offer is just a click away. Most people actually have several browsers open, so it's quite difficult to understand what really are they actually doing at other sites, why they are just apparently deeply engaged in reading what we have to say about the hotel room. So customers have no longer the stickiness from before, or in other words, companies don't own the customer anymore. Well, you would say not that bad. At least the companies know most about their product. Unfortunately, that isn't the case either anymore, because Google knows more about your product than you yourself. I was at Nokia 2 weeks ago in Helsinki, and they gave me a new shiny phone there. And when I wanted to activate the maps, it told me that I have to pay 130 euros to do that. So, you know, I'm not sure Google Maps is free, but maybe Nokia Maps is much better. They bought Navtec after all. So I went online, and it turned out that if you enter Nokia activation maps, no single hit on the first page is Nokia.com. So while they wanted to talk about color schemes in their pages, the problem is nobody goes there. So basically, companies have also not only lost their customer, they don't own the customer, but they also don't own the product anymore. And if you think about social media, about blogs, etc., companies don't own even their message anymore. So, customer value means you need to go where the customer is. Application to business here is Marketing 2.0. That's the title of a course I teach at Berkeley, actually. And if you think about the term one-to-one marketing, probably most of you have heard about 10 years ago. And it meant that the company can target that message on a segment of one. You have all heard that. Unfortunately, this is not how it works. Because if you think about where are those conversations, where are those one-to-one conversations, they are not between the company and the individuals, but the conversations are down here between individuals. So one-to-one marketing is no longer between companies figuring out what they should target you with, but it's about companies allowing social marketing to happen. Now, if you think about recommendations, estimates are that 78% of all internet users research a product before buying it, and that customers prefer peer reviews to expert reviews by a 6-to-1 margin. So people trust other people more than they trust the companies. And here is an example of a paper by Foster Provo at NYU on so-called network-based marketing. That's one very tangible outcome of what I'm talking here with the consumer data revolution. What he did is he compared standard marketing, sophisticated segmentation models based primarily on the experience of the statisticians, the intuitions, and of course all the past data, with a very simple approach. Sell the product to those people who make calls to people who already bought the product. So in one case, demographic, geographic, loyalty data. In the other case, look at the relationships about the node versus about the arc versus about the link. And here's the result. If we normalize the 0.28% of response rate in the traditional model, and these are really good people, they know what they're doing, to let's say 1, then we have a factor of 4.8 by the very simple model of just marketing to people who have made those calls. There are a bunch of startups in this area which have similar ideas. For instance, Oren Hoffman's company called Rapleaf goes out to the LinkedIn's, MySpace, and Facebook's and figures out who you're connected to. So now when you have, let's say, an insurance claim, it figures out, well, how are the people you're connected to doing in terms of insurance claim? And if none of them ever filed anything or just some trivialities, they probably give you green light. On the other hand, if half of your friends tend to file insurance claims quite frequently, then it's worth for the company, for the insurance company, to direct its resources to make the decision to probably investigate that a little bit more deeply. Another example of a company is called Skydeck, S-K-Y-D-E-C-K. Skydeck, you give them your mobile number and you tell them who your carrier is and you give them your password to your carrier's website. They go in and create very, very interesting insights out of your calling behavior, helping you with the decision, whether you're a salesperson or whether you're trying to date somebody, helping you with the decision of who you should make the next call to. Another example here is what Amazon did called Share the Love. Share the Love was that when you buy a book, you could, after you're done with the purchasing, suggest somebody, a friend, say email address, and if that person bought the same book within a week, they get 10% discount, you get 10% credit, and you know, Amazon sold another book and maybe even acquired a new customer. So those are all examples where what Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook calls leveraging the social graph is a way of using very different data sources to come up with selling more. So it's sort of the implicit nature of the graph which allows us to make predictions, and not only make predictions, but to come up with actions. And if you think about how the recommendation space has changed, sometimes I reflect back what has changed in the last 10, 15 years. All these data sources, with the exception of clicks on the right-hand side, to forward, to tell a friend, the attention gesture of annotation, the intention gesture of search, then of course also location data. All of those things, in addition to all the people data here, were not used at Amazon.com in the early days. So for me, the key goal all of predictive modeling has is to help with relevance. So the metrics we should come up with to evaluate the models we build should focus on relevance. And it's not just one metric. I deliberately used the plural here. Jeff Bezos and I spent probably 50 hours to go through Amazon.com, through the various groups, and metrified, or metricized. I think metricized sounds better. Metrified sounds like petrified. Metricized the company to figure out what would be metrics each small group of 5, 8, 10 people can work towards. It's a very good exercise to go through because, for instance, customer service calls. Sure, I can, for instance, just, you know, zero-click shopping, just ship items to you. But in the long term, you know, people might be calling and there might be costs for the company down the road. So if I just see how much did I ship, great metric. On the other hand, if I take into account the fact that people called again, then you come up with a very different objective function. Now, if you talk about calling, it turns out that people who call once and get their problem resolved are actually happier customers than people who never had that experience to have a great customer service experience at Amazon.com. Whereas, on the other hand, people who call twice, i.e. who didn't have their problem resolved the first time, tend to be very unhappy customers. That means you actually have to have a non-first-order Markov model here, which takes into account what has happened in the past. And in terms of internally measuring stuff, It means that those agents who caused the second call to happen, who didn't resolve the problem in the first call, they might need to, you know, maybe think about a different job than being a customer service agent. So those are examples here by instrumenting the company of what you can do differently. But the most important thing I want to end my talk with is to show you the framework of the five steps, I think, which really concretely help you get this done. And notice here that there is no data in there and there is no model in there. So what is in there? So first, and I heard this at the beginning when I asked you what the bottlenecks are, we have to really think about what the problem is. And my experience working with companies, it is often not the problem what they thought it is. For instance, an airline, Singapore Airlines, called me up maybe 3 years ago and said, "Professor Weigand, we hear you're an expert in CRM models. What is the coefficient?" And this, by the way, was my first contact with them, I mean, except as a passenger. I said, "Coefficient for what?" "For CRM." I said, "0.37. I said, "Oh, that's great, thank you. Oh, great, thank you so much for helping." I said, "Do you want to know anything else?" He said, "No, that's what we want to know. Thank you, really." Okay, I said, "Just hold on 1 second. Do you mind sharing with us, you know, with me the problem you try to solve?" "Well, the problem is, what's the coefficient in CRM?" Okay. Now, if they thought about it in the big picture, then they would ask a very different question. They would realize that the loyalty program, Chris Flyer, would probably have very different structure from what it has right now. But those poor, that poor Shaojie in that department who was asked to call me, she just was told, "Find out that coefficient from someone." So reframing the problem tends to be very, very important. Part of the problem for me is also the baseline. In the 90s, I spent a lot of time consulting on Wall Street, working for hedge funds. It's not that popular anymore, I've heard. But those days, it was very popular. People do machine learning, you know, to make some money on the side. And knowing what the baseline is, which could be just a simple buy and hold model, has to be part of the problem definition. Otherwise, you know, it's like the little hare who runs, and comes back the next week and says, "This is what it is. Oh, we always knew how to do that, young man." So baseline is part of the problem. Second one is hypothesis. So for hypotheses, you have to go typically outside of what you normally do. Data mining, predictive modeling, glue programming, as I call it, just hacking stuff together and getting some ideas is how I come up with hypotheses. Cognitive psychology, since I'm interested in how consumers make decisions, is a rich source of hypotheses. So that nobody really can help you with. You know your business better than anybody else, but don't just think about the 0.37. Think about other things why people might be doing stuff. And then the most important thing is derive actions from that. Now, the actions can be trivial, like whether the button should be red or the button should be green, whether the description should turn this way or this way. But it could be also very different things. It could be cross channels. Very difficult to say things in the generality here, but very easy, I think, if you think about your specific problem, which you're going to tackle next Monday. Now, all of this would be useless if we didn't spend some significant time, maybe half a day or a day, to come up with a rich set of metrics. It's surprising for me how little people actually think deeply about metrics. You can measure so much, and by what you measure, and that's why I gave you the example about metricizing Amazon.com, by what you measure, if you have smart people, they move the needle in that direction, and it's up to you to have to find direction. So it's not just sales. It could be, for instance, one is not the same as two. So people who use a Facebook app once are very different from people who use it twice. So you want to understand what moves people from the first behavior to the second behavior and things like that. Just did a workshop last week for a local company here called Contagent, K-O-N-T-A-G-E-N-T. And all they do is they have a set, rich set of canned metrics for Facebook apps, for social apps. So you don't have to write all of that stuff yourself. You can probably easily get it from somebody. And it's very different from the old style Omniture clickstream metrics. It's much more metrics of engagement. Happy to talk more about this in the question period. And then finally, I'm an experimental physicist by training. You do experiments. I loved the keynote yesterday from SAS, who said, well, some people think that they don't have the money for experiments. Doing experiments is too expensive. Well, not doing experiments can be even more expensive. So I completely agree with her statement here. So in my experience, the metrics is something where you can get a relatively quick win by understanding also what the trade-offs are between them. The hypothesis is once you have a culture where people can do experiments, people will come up with hypotheses. And you just give them 1% of the customers and see, or 0.1%, see how they're doing. Very empowering, similar to the Best Buy story of having 100,000 people contribute to the database. So I want to finish with one contrast. Amazon is always called a very data-centric company. That's correct. But more important, I want to talk about not dead data, which many of you think when you think about analysis of data which somebody hands to you. Could I get another column of data, please? Versus live data. And live data for me is just another word of saying we do experiments. So those three stages here of descriptive models, of predictive model, and of doing experiments. That is, I think, important when we talk about data, that we understand those are three very different data sources. So to briefly summarize, we took a historical perspective where we realized that 20, 30 years ago, there was basically nothing compared to what we have now in terms of data. Although, actually this week I got a letter from the German ministry which tries to take care of the Stasi, and I got the cover page of my Stasi folder. I was just so amazed. I mean, why would they be interested in grad students at the time? So people did collect data, even if it takes them 20 years later to actually surface those to the users. The current trend is based on the observation that the communication costs have dropped to zero. That means that the intelligence is no longer actually with the companies which can potentially send out stuff to everybody, but with the end user, right or wrong? Wrong. Because companies that ignore the cost of the end user, the attention cost, sometimes they call it attention rate. You know, the phone is ringing supposedly in some ad and I think it's my phone and it reached the pocket. Companies that ignore the cost of the end user actually ignore an important element for their brand. The customer data revolution is the shift in mindset of the end user of being willing to share if and only if they get something back about themselves and about the relationship with others. That in turn enables us to do social marketing. And social marketing is not a 5% increase, but can be a factor of 5 increase. So think about how you could use virality is another word for it, slightly different, the effects of the social graph in reaching people. Relevance for me is the most important. Predictive analytics for me means how can we focus on coming up with relevant results? And the framework I showed you is what I call the FAME framework. Problem, hypotheses, action, metrics, and experiments. We have a couple of minutes left for questions. Let me thank you for your attention and turn it over to Eric to manage the questions.
Thank you, Andreas.
Can we have the mic here? Any questions? Can you turn on...
Yes, please.
So what I heard from you on the examples of leveraging the social network data is mostly around friends kind of network. So I'm not sure how that can be leveraged as it is directly, but are there other sources of data, which tells you about connection or relationship between people, which you have used, other than this Facebook, around Facebook, which I don't know how to leverage, I don't know if it's, how it's available and how to connect our data sources, I mean, all that. So what are other ways of that relationship exists?
So let me unpack the question into two parts. The first part is, what other social graph data are there? And the other one is, what other, maybe non-social graph data are there? I gave you the example of Amazon's Share the Love, which is a very, you know, Amazon-centric, but non-Facebook, it was 8 years ago already, a way of leveraging information about your friends. Interesting enough, I've never had anybody complain to me that those recommendations were viewed as spam. Because if you set the situation that in that message it says, your pal, Andreas, just bought this book and thought you might be interested in it. People don't perceive as Amazon spamming them, but hey, Andreas thought I'd be interested in that. So that would be one example of doing things outside a Facebook community. If you think about all of viral marketing is defined as the user acquisition cost being zero. There are many more examples of forwarding things to people. You as a company pay nothing, and it's the same idea as Share the Love, that it doesn't get perceived as spam. So Facebook was just one example here, because I think potentially, particularly if you think about newsfeed for discovery, they have enormous opportunities, but in terms of the models they built, the predictive models they built, in terms of the relevance, there's a lot of space for improvement. So the other question I heard you say was, what other data sources are there? And there, only the sky is the limit. I gave you as an example geolocation data. And I do believe that as far as mobile phones go, we are only seeing the very, very beginning of what we could be doing in terms of using geolocation, using movement, using co-location, for more relevant results. So at the Where to O conference last year, there was a company, and I fortunately forgot the name of it, which had a bunch of receivers around there, and then looked, based on the phone ID number, looked at how people were moving. And if you're moving and you're spending more time at the, say, SPSS stand, and you go back to it, maybe it's time for the SPSS person to actually make you a deal, because after all, you came back. So there's lots of data sources, in this case, specifically not web data, but data about how people move.
Okay, so I'm interested in the H part of the thing. Identifying the problem is, takes a lot of communication, action, metrics, experiments, or a lot of hard work. H is the creative part.
Yes. Okay. So if you have 15 minutes, I talked with a friend of mine, Dan Ariely, who I did consulting with at a number of places, from Match.com to Swiss International Airlines, on my blog, Viking.com. We had a 15-minute conversation in December on that topic. Dan wrote a book called Predictably Irrational, of basically saying, look, in this day and age where we now have so much more data, those principles that basically we can be traditional neoclassic economists who look at all the data, value hypothesis, and come up with a decision is no longer the case. It never was the case, by the way, but it's even less the case now. So read a little bit on how people actually make decisions, and I think Dan's book is just super great, gives you ideas about that. And then it is listen to what's out there on the web. So I gave you as an example that Nokia map activation, and I encourage you, if you want to come up with hypotheses, what could be the case, hey, just search on Google or search on Yahoo, and you'll get lots of hypotheses of what people are saying. So this is both actually really cheap. One costs you 10, 20 bucks and a few hours of reading a book. The other one, basically, is, I would think, half a day of getting a feeling. Let me give you a specific example for these hypotheses, actually. And since I travel so much, it is an example from an airline. And when I went to Europe last month, they asked me, would you like to, in business class, to have your head to the front or to the back of the airplane? I said, what are you talking about? And said, oh, we have these new fly flat and so on and so forth. And I said, well, you know, to the back of the airplane. And then I looked online and came up with this on flatseats.com, looked at the first three reviews. United Airlines business star seat review from January 2009, and that's when I said, yeah, I take the Lufthansa flight. Because, you know, I have the choice between head to the front or head to the back, but the rest is pretty lousy. Now, why am I giving you this example? I'm giving you this example that if the airline thought about this, they would save lots of money of probably actually, I don't know how much it costs, probably millions of dollars to, you know, retool their business class by learning what people say. And look at the comment at the very bottom where the person says, I just don't understand why United could not think outside the box. So it's about organizing, about culture, the point you mentioned at the beginning. It's fun. Doing the hypothesis generation, I've done it with a number of firms, and people really tend to enjoy that. You have to prompt them a little bit, but then at some stage, you know, all of the people in the company do think about the product, they better do. And if you just enable them to come up with ideas, which don't get crushed because it's arm wrestling or the highest paid person who makes a decision, but yeah, you can try that too. Doesn't work for airplanes, but does work in the e-business.
So that's all we've got time for. That was great, Andreas. Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Thanks, that was terrific. So we have a...